of a ticket to the land of the free. Well, he say his home's in Frisco, where they send the rye, but it's really in Tennessee. That's why he say, I need someone to love me, need somebody to carry me home to San Francisco and bury my body. I need someone to lend me a $50 bill, and then I'll leave Hong Kong far behind me for happiness once again. Won't someone be neat? I begin to see that bay again, but when I tried to leave, sweet local mammals let me fly away.
Well, good evening, friends. Welcome back. It's Progressive News Network. I'm your host, Rick Spezak. I'm back from a visit to Virusville and feeding the little biddies. And I'm just about recovered my full power. And it's time for Progressive News Network. We have some wonderful guests, and of course, we are so proud, as always, to bring you the voice and the intelligence of Ms. Brooke Hines, who has joined us tonight once again for her insight on the dilemmas at hand. And let's see, I need to take a second. Okay, here we go. Ladies and gentlemen, let me be bringing you the charming and talented Ms. Brooke Hines. Hey, Brooke.
Hey there.
How you doing tonight?
I am great. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. I have to admit that I succumbed to the very special staging that's been occurring for the conventions, the debates this year, where they put debates on so that no one will watch them.
They're doing that on purpose, you know.
I suspect as much, since very little is done in the world of commercial politics. That is what we're calling it these days. So that just the right audience, presumably and preferably none, can actually hear the faux pas and the misaligned policies and out-and-out, populist screeching of some of these candidates. So, tell me, what have you been following this last week?
Well, on the note of the Saturday debate that we had a while back, I did notice that there might have been an unanticipated fallout, which is that it fell on a Saturday. It tended to dominate the Sunday shows and then into the news cycle for the beginning of the week. So I think that it had more of an impact for a longer time than it would have had it fallen on, say, like a Thursday.
But of course, the war profiteers did get their commercials throughout.
Right.
Nothing like another war.
It was a tiny audience.
Which is good, because Dr. Ben's most unkindest cut of all may yet be ahead of us.
Right. And one of the things that I found remarkable about that debate that I wrote about pretty soon after it was, and a lot of people flagged this, was Hillary Clinton's appeal to 9/11 that she made. Gosh, it's been so long that I almost forgot about this. That she seemed to, in the debate, she seemed to be claiming victim status for financial institutions in
New
York during 9/11. Mm-hmm. And so any special attention that she would be giving Wall Street interests, we should understand that as her, you know, taking the side of people who were victimized during 9/11, and rather than taking the side of Wall Street interests against Main Street interests.
Yeah, I never thought I'd see a politician draw a crooked line between Wall Street and 9/11. I thought as a bit of political flourish, it was quite outstanding.
Yeah. Well, and you know, the timing on that is pretty remarkable, because you would expect that to have happened. Would expect a politician to maybe use that appeal to 9/11 closer to 9/11 than, say, you know, 2015. I mean, this is a very strange time for her to be using this actual kind of argument. But what had happened Saturday, the reason why she was deploying this argument was there was a terrorist attack in Paris. And the way that I saw this coming together, the way I imagine her team coming together and her debate practice working, is, okay, we've got this terrorist attack in Paris. You're the former Secretary of State. You're going to have to go hard on foreign policy. So what we're going to do is we're going to position you in a way that is going to make it easy to take all of this Wall Street stuff off the table forever. It's a device to triangulate around Wall Street and make you look great in terms of being tough on terrorism all around the board. And so when Bernie Sanders was given the opportunity after the third commercial break to talk about Wall Street and Wall Street giving money to Hillary Clinton, she started to go down this road where she was comfortable, and I think that she's used this before, because you could tell that it was just a knee-jerk reaction, where she was starting to go down this sexism road, where she was saying, well, now I take offense to that. The 60% of my donors are women, and you're impugning my integrity. And then she stops in her tracks. She turns around and she says, but wait. And she deploys this 9/11 defense. And she says that what's really going on here is that I'm really supporting the interests of people who, as the senator from New York, it was my duty to work with them after 9/11, and they were victimized, and it was terrible, and these interests are being targeted by terrorists, and yada yada yada, and she took a second whack at it when a Twitter commenter, the panel, I forget what it was NBC or CBS, but the moderator allowed her a second bite of the apple. And a Twitter person said, you know, this is really remarkable that we're actually seeing a Democratic person, you know, use this talking point, this 9/11 talking point. And she doubled down on it. Instead of moving away or softening the message to any degree, she doubles down on it. And so there's no, that left everyone with no doubt that her intent was to associate the two, 9/11 and Wall Street interests being victimized, to the extent that the New York Times actually did a board editorial, you know, chastising her for using this kind of rhetorical device. And that never happened.
Well, you know, I hate to be brutal about it, but to smear a little 9/11 blood to defend yourself against being the sycophant of Wall Street, I mean, it was just beyond the pale. And especially to do it in the context of the Parisian problems recently. Mm-hmm. You know, to go down so hard, to tie, you know, your Wall Street behavior and to limit any criticism of Wall Street by equating it with terrorism, it is so dishonest as to be really completely beyond the pale. And as you say, for the Times to make any criticism of a 9/11 anything, I thought, mm-hmm. I agree, it was completely remarkable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she was basically saying regulate Wall Street and the terrorists win.
That's right.
Really, wow.
And then,
that
of
was,
course...
That was the, yes, go ahead.
I was just going to say, and among the list of remarkable behaviors we've seen was the defense of putting an end to immigration by two senators who are direct benefits of immigration themselves, for themselves and their family, the Cruz and
right.
Rubio twins.
Right. Well, I actually would expect no less from either of those guys. It's been a crazy week, especially with regards to immigration and with regards to the refugee legislation that was passed in the House, you know, with the 47 Democrats signing on to you know, the horrible piece of legislation that the Republicans wrote. You know,
we have an intermittent Democrat over here who hung with his buds in the
mm-hmm.
Republican Party on that one.
Yep. And you're seeing, you know, the Republican governors all responding to the calls of their right wing think tanks to, you know, line up and you know, spread the fear of, oh my gosh, what if Syrian refugees were to make it to U.S. shores, you know, while at the same time, you know, the terrorists who attacked Paris were all European. You know, we weren't talking about refugees. It wasn't refugees who attacked Paris. You know, all of the fear-mongering, it's pointed, and it's all going in a direction. And where it's going, where I see it going, is, you know, we had this report this week, just the other day, of the, you know, the armed gunmen showing up at a mosque in Texas, you know, saying that they want to, you know, use a show of force to make the Muslims get out of the great state of Texas or whatever. And you know, you had the protester who was beaten up at the Donald Trump rally.
Which he defended.
Black Lives Matter.
He actually defended it, yeah.
Right. And earlier this week, Donald Trump also went way out into the stratosphere with his xenophobic rhetoric, saying that he wanted to have a registry of immigrants, you know, to add this to the crazy wall built of dinosaur bones or whatever, that's going to have the beautiful gate that has Trump's name over it or whatever. Now he's going to have a registry and, I don't know, tattoos or RFID chips or whatever it is. And he's doubling down and doubling down and doubling down again with this rhetoric that sounds, for all intents and purposes, this rhetoric reminds people of you know, World War II. It reminds people of, you know, what the Germans did in World War II. You know,
I thought that Jeb! Exclamation point. Made a very interesting point, too, in case that anybody doubted his own zany credentials, when he suggested that only Christians are pure enough and good enough to come to this great country, land of the free and home of the brave, where we don't measure your religion, except maybe Jeb does.
Well, and that's what's so scary, is that it's being... we're being separated by religion. And so instead of, like during World War II, instead of being separated, you know, where the Germans separated people into, you know, the people of Jewish faith you know, people as you know, Aryan faith or whatever, you know, the old religions that they, you know, the old anyway. Now we've flipped it and it's the Muslim religions, and so it's just so ridiculous that you've got armed gunmen showing up at mosques, and if these were armed gunmen showing up at any other place of worship, if it were a synagogue, if it was a Baptist church, if it was, you know, a Catholic church, people would be losing their minds. But because it was a mosque, for some reason, the nature of the story just becomes like a blip on Huffington Post, or, you know, an interest piece that liberal bloggers talk about, you know, as kind of a taking the temperature of people in the heartland or something, and it's just not given the seriousness that I think that it deserves. This is not only a very extreme act, but it's an extreme act that is being backed up by people with a lot of power. It's being backed up by presidential candidates, and it's being backed up with the whole faith and power of the Republican Party and you know, everyone in that camp. Nobody in the Republican Party is standing up and saying, hey, why don't y'all knock that off? Why don't y'all settle down or turn it down or anything? No, they're saying more of that and right on, and you know, they're trying to one up each other. So, you know, nobody is the adult in the room, and nobody is trying to assert any sort of narrative that I can recognize as an American ideal or a democratic ideal or anything that I can be proud of as an American that I would recognize from a history book, at least from the Republican side of things.
I remember when many of us who were, you know, politically attentive to what goes on, I remember how surprised we were when the former candidate for vice president, Ms. Palin, ventured the opinion that when asked what magazine she reads, first she blanked, and then she said, well, all of them. She reads all of them. And, of course, I know we were all amazed when Trump said that he gets all his political advice and guidance from watching TV. But I thought that Dr. Carson really achieved a new level of ignorance when asked by a Fox interviewer who did he see as our natural allies in the Middle East. Couldn't think of one.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I tend to write off kiss and tells, and you know, you probably heard, as I did, that his recent security analyst and advisor of several months basically called him out as a guy who couldn't learn anything at all. But mm-hmm. That being said, if you can't come up on a Fox News, a friendly interview, you couldn't come up with one ally in the Middle East. This is a fellow who is actively inattentive. This isn't just ignorant. This isn't just, I'm a man, I almost stabbed somebody, or I did stab somebody, but luckily their buckle came in the way. I put a hammer mm-hmm. to my mother's head to, I guess, show us that he's a real hard ass and, you know, potential homicidal criminal. So he is qualified for president. But I thought that this level of ignorance about the Middle East, which I don't know if you noticed, but it's in the news,
mm-hmm.
was really, really remarkable.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it reminds me of Ronald Reagan. Every time Ronald Reagan stepped in it, and he stepped in it frequently, with regard to, you know, not having adequate knowledge of, you know, who our allies were, what geography was, you know, what important points of history were, he was forgiven it because essentially what Ronald Reagan was a spokesperson, he was a corporate spokesperson selling a form of corporate democracy, you know, or corporatocracy. That's
sure.
That's what his role was. And that's the role that Ben Carson is up for. He's really not up for president of the United States or commander in chief. He's up for, you know, corporatocracy spokesperson in chief. And to have that job, it's not important that you understand anything about, you know, the Middle East or any of that stuff. You're going to have a vice president who's like Dick Cheney, who takes care of all of that for you. You know, be on the lookout. If he does get the nomination, God willing, he won't. Be on the lookout for who actually is his running mate, because that's who would be actually running things. That would be the man behind the curtain.
What was your? I know you were working on a column recently. What was your latest column?
What I just published moments before I got on is a piece on Bernie Sanders' Democratic Socialism speech, and I watched that, and then I watched all 10 episodes of the Philip K. Dick series on Amazon, The Man in the High Castle.
Uh-huh.
So the piece that I wrote is how to spot a threat to democracy, Bernie Sanders and Philip K. Dick on radicalism and revolt. And what I found really interesting about Bernie Sanders' speech and what I was hoping to hear going into his speech was something moving. Because what's missing in the whole kind of Bernie Sanders tableau is he's really good at giving these laundry lists and telling us what's wrong and giving us a sense of scale of, you know, what's the boundaries of our suffering, you know, and measures of how bad things are, but, you know, how do we get from there to actually doing something about it? And I think that he really achieved that in his speech when he said, you know, we have a power structure built around inequality. Around the first third of the speech, he was talking about FDR, and he was going through these laundry lists, and he was being very clear about what democratic socialism is and what it isn't, and he was tying it to the New Deal and FDR and how we came out of the Depression. But then he goes into FDR's Second Bill of Rights, and he talks about why it is that we have to pay attention to things like infrastructure and Social Security and minimum wage. Why are these things important? And the reason why they're important is that if you don't have economic security, if families are economically insecure, then they are not free. And right now, we have a power structure. We have our whole political system is built around and reinforces inequality. And so what he did was he took this definition of he defined democratic socialism he defined democratic socialism as this way of addressing inequality. And then he says that if we don't address these things, if we don't address inequality, then we're going to lose democracy because none of us are free. If we don't have equality, then we don't have freedom, then we don't have justice, then we lose our democracy. All of these things are taken together. And to not have one and to have a power structure that is so reinforcing to not have equality across the board is undermining all the rest of it. And so he sounded the alarm to a degree that I have never really heard before. And so what I did with the piece was I said, you know, he kind of did this in his regular kind of Bernie Sanders way. I mean, I was talking to my husband about it today. Like Bernie Sanders hasn't changed since 1962 in a way. He's a lot like Philip K. Dick. He's a lot like the Man in the High Castle. He's the same guy he's been since the early 60s. He thinks in these same terms, and he's not going to change. So he gets up there and he talks in these same kind of, you know, let's get out there and darn our socks kind of way. And you got to kind of listen for what it is that he's saying, because he's not going to just get up and say, with his hair on fire, and say, you know, get out there in the streets and do something because, you know, everything's going to hell. That's not his style. But as I was working on the Bernie Sanders part of the piece, I stopped and I put it down and I watched all of this alternate history, all this Philip K. Dick stuff, which is about two things. It's about if the Axis powers had won World War II and taken over the United States and were actually under Nazi rule and Japanese rule in the West, and it's about the power of alternative narratives. Both of these things are ideas, I think, that wrap into the Bernie Sanders narrative. And so I work with that in this piece. It sounds long and difficult, but it really isn't. I think that what Bernie Sanders is doing, whether or not he wins the election or not, he's interrupting a narrative that we're being told is necessary. We're being told that Hillary Clinton is a necessary narrative. We're being told that there is no way we can stop Wall Street, and that there's no way that we can stand in the way of, or stop any of these forces that are privatizing and corporatizing every part of our lives, and that they're coming for our Social Security, and they're coming for our schools, and they're coming for everything that that we're familiar with, and there's nothing that we can do. Well, Bernie Sanders is interrupting that narrative, and it is throwing people off. So that's one part of it. That's just a little piece of it.
Well, that sounds excellent. And where can our listeners tune in to find it?
They can, thefloridasqueeze.com. And
okay,
it's just posted up there. And follow me on Twitter, Nashville_Brooks. And I'm also on Facebook as Brooke Hines. And that's about it.
Well, thank you so much, Brooke. I really appreciate it. As always, you bring us a keen insight into the political challenges of the day. Let me take one more second and ask you this.
Mm-hmm.
When you look back now on the convention, the Florida Democratic
mm-hmm.
Convention, any final thoughts on that front?
You know, that's interesting. After the Republicans had their convention, and, you know, you spent a couple of days reading the press, of these guys, you know, having all of their candidates here, it seems like every piece opened up with, you know, all you have to do to see the difference between the Republicans and the Democrats in Florida in the balance of power is that we were able to bring all of our candidates here and the Democrats had nobody. And I think that that has left a lot of the Democrats in Florida scratching their heads. It's left some of us demoralized, but it's left a lot of people kind of, you know, energized and ready to do something else. And that reminds me to plug the STEP report, because there's a renewed there's a renewed energy for people to get involved and to kind of not worry what the party itself is doing and just make things happen on their own. Bernie Sanders' campaign is ramping up in Florida. People are getting involved in that. And the Progressive Caucus did the Strategies and Tactics for Electing Progressives report, the STEP report, which is a great kind of handbook to get your feet wet and get started to get out there and start making some change happen on your own. So these are some great little pieces part to, I'm not going to say subvert the system, but, you know, you can walk around things. My mother used to say, you know, don't worry about what other people are doing, just walk around it. And that's, I think that's where a lot of really good progressives are right now. We're just not worried about what's going on with the party. We're just going to walk around it at this point.
I hear a rumor that they're going to run Charlie Crist for every open Democratic seat. Is that possible?
They might be cloning him at this very moment.
Thanks again, Brooke.
They should just stamp him out.
You take care.
I hope you feel better. You too.
Thanks. Well, next, thank you. Bye-bye. Next up, we've got the wonderful guest, Dennis Campbell, who is a publisher of the UK Progressive. He's also producer and part of the Three Muckrakers that you can find on iTunes and many other places. Let me play the interview with him. He is a remarkable fellow who comments on things UK as well as USA and, of course, on the continent. So let me bring you Mr. Dennis Campbell, and here we go. Ladies and gentlemen, I would like to welcome one of my favorite guests, one of the Three Muckrakers, producer, also the publisher of the UK Progressive, a man of great depth and study, a man of astute political acumen. I'd like to welcome Mr. Dennis Campbell.
Oh, wow, I didn't know who you were talking about there for a second. Thank you, sir.
Well, I think you fit generally in that category, yeah.
Good afternoon. How are you, sir?
Very good, very good. So tell me, before we get started on the world, let's talk about a more important subject. How is your candidacy going? Is there still a candidacy?
Oh, there is. There is. We just came out of conference last week, which is it's an interesting phenomenon. You know, how parties have platform committees. Well, ours is no different.
I thought that was investors.
Well, the Lib Dems tend to be fairly traditional, a fairly traditional liberal party here in the UK. And we had our conference in Swansea, which is about 45 minutes to the west of here. And it was for all of Wales, since the Welsh Assembly is, you know, all 60 seats are up being contested. We got together. And before the conference, there was this opportunity for people to submit a number of ideas to the policy committee. And the policy committee sat down and kind of coalesced all the ideas into basically 9 platform items. And then they published those, and people had an opportunity over the course of several weeks to then decide what they liked or didn't like about something. And they could then present amendments to the policy committee. And what we do in conference is that we actually sit down and we debated each of the 9 items, whether you are for or against a particular motion that's put on the floor, as well as the amendments. And what was really interesting about it was that several of the amendments that really were not high on the list of those who run the party on a daily basis passed. So they're actually going to be incorporated into our statement that we'll be running on come, you know, the 1st of January as we head into the actual election for May. So it's a true democratic process, and it was really fun to watch. As far as my campaign, I've officially been selected here in the Vale of Glamorgan, which is a very broad area. It's about 70,000 voters. It extends for about 20 miles tip to toe. And then 10 miles north to south or so. It's a largely rural area, but it has several good-sized cities and towns in it. So looking forward to going out there and knocking on doorsteps and talking up with people. But generally, this response has been, huh, I didn't see that coming. I didn't think that that would be something that you would do, but I can see how that might work. So we're taking it straight to Labour. That's the party of the new leader, Jeremy Corbyn, but here in Wales, it's a completely different party. And they've been largely ineffectual for 17 years. So we're going to, you know, run against their horrific record for 17 years. and then the Tories, the other big party, and we're going to run against them on the basis of all the craziness they're doing right now in Westminster. So it's a perfect opportunity, because this is what's known as a swing district, a marginal, they're called here. And we have a Tory member of parliament in Westminster in London, and we have a Labour AM in the assembly, which is what I'm going after. So with the right message and the, you know, the right commitment and the right authenticity, I think we have a chance.
Well, that's great. Now, I think last time we spoke, you had talked about there was a nuclear power issue, and also that there were still quite a bit of discussion, if I'm not mistaken, about the NIH. What are the current hot button issues in your candidacy?
Well, the you know, for me, you know, I take a page out of Bill Clinton's 1992 book. It's The Economy, Stupid. You know, for me, our economy is 70% dependent on the government teat in one form or another. You either work directly for the government, or you work for an agency who's in existence because of extensive government funding, whether it's from Wales and Cardiff Bay, Westminster, or the European Union. So that's no way to sustain an economy and grow. And indeed, what I would like to bring is a public-private partnership very similar to what we did when the Beacon Council first started down there in Miami, to get people together to start going to companies and to organizations and to countries to say, look, we have a great story here in Wales. We have a great workforce. We have an economic opportunity for businesses to actually locate here at much lower cost than they could with a first world infrastructure and everything. So it's really a positive message about Wales Incorporated. So we're hoping to be able to get that out there. The other big issue is the ineptness of the Labour government here. We've been dealing with ridiculous pronouncements and ridiculous moves of late that make no fiscal sense. For example, you know, they're about to spend £325 million on a Formula One style racing track in the Ebba Valley, which would be okay if you weren't also cutting hundreds of millions of pounds from local authority budgets and roads and bridges and infrastructure. So it's a bit of a double-edged sword. They recently announced that 100 jobs were created, but when you read the fine print and you started to look into the press release, it really isn't 100 jobs. It's 33 jobs this year, maybe 33 next year, maybe 33 the year after, with one of the largest consultancy firms in the world, Capgemini, who they paid £1.4 million to set up this particular infrastructure building that they're going to be operating out of. So you find yourself shaking your head saying, you know, we wouldn't spend that kind of money when we were on the Beacon Council to attract 100 jobs. We wouldn't do that to attract 10,000 jobs. It just made no sense whatsoever, some of the decisions that were being taken and the way in which they were. And the big issue right now is a complete lack of transparency within the Welsh Assembly. And our party has been going after them on it because they wanted to stop producing ministerial reports, which says basically this is what the government's been up to. They said, well, nobody reads them. But, you know, other politicians, I said, well, this is, you know, the media reads them as well. And this is how you keep on track of on top of what's going on inside the government. So transparency, housing. There's all sorts of issues related to unbridled and uncontrolled development without anyone taking a look at what's happening with the infrastructure that's needed, such as schools for all these kids that will be coming in, for the roadways, which are being ripped up by all this extra traffic. And, you know, these are all politics is local. So these are local issues. You know, when you talk about nuclear power, yes, they did approve in England, out of Parliament at least, the Chinese investment in the Somerset plant, which is just across the water literally from here, you know, about 15 miles in the other direction. And, you know, that has people a little bit worried because, yes, it is new generation nuclear, but it's still nuclear. And, you know, when you've got idiots like IS out there willing to do anything anywhere, you start to worry about the viability of something like that. Yet they're cutting funds for the tidal barrage. We have the second highest tide in the world here, in this particular area where I live, and that is, you know, going on 8 meters today. It'll be 10 meters next Wednesday when it's at full moon, and then it swings all the way down to, you know, 1.2 meters. And the energy that that generates, that tide coming in and out, could be used to generate hydroelectric, very clean energy. And indeed, the government in Westminster, the Tory government, just turned around and gave £5.9 billion, it's about $10 billion, to the big oil companies for North Sea oil exploration, while at the same time cutting all subsidies for wind power and solar power here in this country, saying that we can't afford it. So you start to look at, you know, the ebb and flow of things, and, you know, the strict austerity that's coming down the pipe, and the fact of the matter is that money's never been cheaper, and if you're going to invest in infrastructure, if you're going to build things for the future, do it at 0% as opposed to when you try to do it at 10 or 12% because you need to.
Well, that's unfortunately where the money goes and who benefits is the story everywhere. Let me ask you this. With all that we've heard in the news of the recent refugees from the Middle East, now conflated with this recent attack by some, and I was just wondering, how does the recent Parisian incident, we'll leave it relatively undefined because it really hasn't been sorted out yet, how has that had an impact in the political season? And what are you hearing on the streets of Wales?
Well, you know, I think everybody's a bit more nervous than before, but nothing like what I've seen on your media. I mean, just and the lunacy. We talked about this on the podcast. We taped the podcast yesterday, and it's now up, episode 52. And we entitled it Je suis Paris and Lebanon, because the day before Paris, there was a horrific explosion killing 100-odd people in Lebanon. And that's one of the few places in the world where the refugees that are brought into that country are not housed in camps, as is the case in most of the Middle East. And the camps are where, you know, you manage to create an environment that is so horrific for people trying to get out, that that's where your jihadis are created, and that's where the despair comes from, and that's what creates a situation where people are willing to get on to, you know, pay a lot of money to get onto rubber dinghies and may or may not make it to Lesbos in Greece, where they can then say they're in Europe and try and find their way across. I mean, it's a horrific situation, and the guy that did it is Belgian. I mean, he spent his entire life there. Most of the terrorists that committed the atrocities in Paris were homegrown here. They had nothing to do with the Syrian refugee crisis. The Syrian refugees are no different than the Jewish refugees that tried to come over to Florida just before they were sent back on the boat to be later be gassed by Hitler in the 1930s. I mean, it's no different situation. If you had the chance to go home tonight and you knew that the only way you were going to be able to save your wife, your children, your family was to somehow take them down across an entire continent to then get on a rubber boat to escape the life that is so bad that that's a reasonable option, is just is nothing that anybody can really imagine. And everybody has the answers. I mean, even my own nephew the other day, you know, was discussing, you know, and becoming this Tea Party, saying, you know, we have a feckless president who doesn't, you know, we should be doing 20,000 sorties and we should be doing this, that, and the other thing. And I said, what is that going to solve? I mean, this isn't as clear as it was. And by clear, I mean, you know, clear by George W. Bush standards, you know, where they just said, we're going to go after Iraq, we're going to go after Afghanistan. You start dropping bombs in there, you're going up against Russia, Lebanon, Iran, Iraq, possibly Saudi Arabia, Lebanon, which is Hamas, all of these different groups. So where do you start dropping bombs? I'm glad that you've got a president right now that thinks before he acts and sits there and says, okay, what happens? Because A plus B does not equal C. You've got all these gray areas, but yet all of these pundits go on television, on the Fox News and every place else, and it's all black and white, and they've got all the answers. I mean, I've been looking at Trump. Trump last night got into a ton of trouble because he decided that he was going to put a registry together for all Muslims in the United States. What could go wrong there? I mean, it's just absolutely insane.
Beyond making clearly into focus the fact that these, so many of these Republican candidates have absolutely no apparent appreciation of the American Constitution, the American Bill of Rights. You know, when you're talking about restricting things of Muslims or organizing a list of Muslims, this is so beyond the pale. But I think it speaks very strongly to the effectiveness on the low information voter of, you know, the repetitive right-wing propaganda, the Tea Party propaganda, that has basically made no bit of foolishness beyond the pale.
Oh, it's just, I mean, and it's getting worse, which you never thought could be possible. I mean, I was watching, you know, we had our podcast, and I can't remember who they all were, but there were the four or five presidential candidates all had a solution to, you know, what was going to happen and what needed to be done. I'm just trying to find it on my script. Okay. Cruz and Rubio, Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio. We should take no Syrian refugees. Now, this is despite their own parents having fled Castro's Cuba to come to the United States. Tough guy Chris Christie in New Jersey. No Syrian refugees, no exceptions, even for orphans under fire. I'm like, really? You know, we always refer to Jeb Bush as Jeb with an exclamation point. They can only come if they're Christians. What the? I mean, it's just insane. And then Ben Carson, he would build a coalition to defeat ISIS, but he couldn't name a single U.S. ally in the region when asked twice. These guys couldn't win an election for dog catcher, yet they're running for the presidency of the United States. And you got a guy like Donald Trump out there who's going to treat it like it's some sort of, you know, you can turn the White House into the next Trump casino, for God's sake. It's just insane, the lack of respect they have for any institutions or anybody, I mean, even the veterans. I mean, they'll use them as props when they need them to justify their wars, but then they won't pay for their medical care. They're trying to privatize the VA. And so you look at this and you wonder, where is the outrage? Why are these low information? I mean, we had low information voters here that put the Tories in power because they found a Frank Luntz simple meme. The SNP-backed Labour Party is bad for Britain, dangerous for Britain, excuse me, not bad, dangerous for Britain. And 650 candidates across the United Kingdom repeated that phrase in lockstep anytime a camera or a microphone was pointed in their direction. And you know what? Fear worked here. The 85-year-old lady who lives down the street who's voted Labour her entire life turned around and said, well, you know, dear, I'd love to, but I can't see you getting into bed with the Scottish people. We don't want them taking over Westminster. I mean, it's just incredible the level of deceit and the level of fear that people use. And we've got to combat that in our campaigning with facts. You know, refugees are welcome here. They should be. They provide a huge service. They're not the leeches that are going to be the, you know, the economic vagrants that are just going to take benefits for the rest of their lives. They want to build a life. They want to get back on their feet. They want to be safe. How the hell can we deny them that opportunity when the Statue of Liberty stands in New York Harbor with the words, give me your tired and your poor, your huddled masses yearning to be free, breathe free. I mean, the rest of that line is the wretched refuse of your teeming cross. Show me the homeless tempest tossed to thee. I lift my lamp beside your golden door. It's right there. And thousands of the good refugees? I mean, the Italians were loathed when they came in the 20s, as were the Irish, for God's sake. So what made them good? The fact that they have white skin or that they don't have brown skin? The fact that they were Christians or that they're not Muslims? I mean, we've got to stop all this labeling crap and recognize who we are, who we were, and what we should be going forward.
Well, it is profoundly disturbing the impact that the incredible dialogue that our election scheme has taken. I'm sure you're as amazed as I am that some of the statements made by these people are so well received and seem to be perfectly within standing. From Marco Rubio to this curiosity, let's say, this misplaced medical professional who seems to have captured the attention of so many by simply being placid.
Oh, and because he's black.
Yes, here.
Honest to God, Republicans just want to be able to say, look, we've got a black guy too, see? We're not racist.
And the pure venom visible dripping from the from Ms. Farina's proposals are
She's an evil woman. She really is. She really is. I've met her before, and I've seen her in action as a businesswoman. And let me tell you, you could see how she drove that company into the ground very simply, very easily.
Well, let me ask you another question.
Sure.
You
got fired up today, Rick.
Good. I'm glad to hear it. You know, it's not often enough that we have your wisdom and the wisdom of so many people who are across the sea from us. When you hear the now attempted to be branded evil meme of democratic socialism, when those of us who have any appreciation for history don't find the term in any way problematic, and yet people with apparently no visible means of intellectual support can be so horrified, you would think that they're proposing Castro and reviving Lenin.
To the left of Hugo Chavez.
Trump with his political acumen assessing Senator Sanders as pure communist. I have to imagine there are actual communists, unrepentant Trotskyites, who find that more than laughable.
Yeah. The interesting thing is that both Trump and Sanders have generated the most attention, as has Jeremy Corbyn here in the United Kingdom, for one reason. They're authentic. Now, you may not like who they are and what they stand for, but you know who they are. And they haven't changed in the last two decades, if not longer. So I think authenticity is something that is going to be a real issue in this election coming forward. Do I believe that this person is being authentic with me before I cast my vote? I think that's got to be a key measure. I mean, when I start talking to people, whether they're, installing the boiler here in my house or whatever, and I just say, look, do you want to continue to keep going in the direction you've been going, or do you want to make a change and see something different? Then you got to change. You can't just vote mindlessly for the Labour Party because your family's done it for the last 50 years. You've got to find a way to look at all of the candidates, all of the platforms, figure out what's real, and then what are you going to do there? I think Bernie's going to do very well until he gets to South Carolina, but he's managed to ask the right questions. And I think that's a key part of elections today, because win or lose, if the right questions are asked, they're still going to be there and they're still going to need to get answers going forward.
I think you're absolutely right there. When we think about making this choice and what was once called the absolute inevitability of Hillary Clinton, and we see how, she has the money, clearly. She has the investment apparatus behind her. And yet we see, when you look at the numbers of investors in Senator Sanders' campaign, you have to say, which one is the crowd pleaser? Which one's speaking to important issues? You have to say Senator Sanders has spoken to more voters than Ms. Clinton has, regardless of the money involved.
It's going to be interesting once we get into March, April, May, because then you'll begin to see whether Bernie has the staying power. The other big issue is right now Hillary has a 10-1 lead in the superdelegates. And that's a bit like rigging the deck in your favor. That's not particularly good. So that has me worried, because she's doing a lot of the same things that she did in 2008 against Barack Obama. And we all saw how that turned out. Now, she's got a tremendous resume. She's got tremendous skills, tremendous abilities. The one thing she is missing is empathy. She's missing the ability to really connect. And I don't think she sees it as important in this particular contest. And to me, it's that connection with voters that is going to be the most important thing for whoever the candidate is. I mean, Donald Trump is the last person I would ever consider voting for, but look at the way people respond to him. Now, is it because of his celebrity and television and money and everything else? Could very well be. And there's that authenticity factor there, and that plays a role.
Well, I think when you use the term authenticity and connection, I think you very much explain the gap between the appeal of Senator Sanders and what passes for the sedan chair that Senator Clinton has arrived in, prepared long in advance and with quality investment. Of very powerful forces in this country. And when you say, and I think quite accurately, that she doesn't even notice that she's not connecting. When I look at the social media addressing both the candidacy of Ms. Clinton, Senator, Secretary of State Clinton, and Senator Sanders, what I see from the Hillary supporters is either canned messages that are clearly mass-produced, and I see a vehemence and an invective on the part of her supporters attacking anyone who has the slightest criticism of her candidacy. It is really just remarkable, the difference in tone.
It is, and Team Hillary has fallen into the same trap again. I mean, you have this massive organization with lots of structures and an inner circle and then everybody else trying to get into the inner circle and you know, go back to Mark Penn and, you know, back when she first ran and, you know, he ended up getting his ass fired because they built a structure that was unwieldy, that was not particularly good. At least they've done one thing right. They've hired most of Obama's digital team, which is smart. The problem is that they don't have as an advisor a Plouffe or an Axelrod. And I think that's the one thing that made Plouffe and Axelrod effective was that they could walk into the boss, Obama, and say, you're doing it wrong and you need to change this. And if you don't, this is what will happen. Nobody on Team Hillary has the guts to do that. They're all trying to protect their backsides and make certain that there'll be a good job for them when she wins, you know, next November. It's really no way to run a campaign. It's a prescription for disaster, as we saw before. And surround yourself with yes men and yes women all the time, because if you do, you'll never be told what you need to hear.
I know several times I was taken upon by Miss Senator Clinton's minions. And, you know, not once was one of my criticisms rebutted. There was no rebuttal. There was no response to whether it be her enthusiasm for war as a solution, her enthusiasm for coups and takeovers, her enthusiasm for a military solution for any possible problem. It was simply invective and attack. And, you know, I actually indulged several of these different people at different times in 2 and 3 hour response cycles. And because I figured in the long run, I would rather wear them out than see them feel that they've had some kind of success in that approach. And I would call them on it. I said, you know, look at the vulgarities you have used in response to, you know, tactical criticism, in response to behaviors and supports and policies that she's undertaken. You know, have you no actual response to these criticisms? is your...
No, they don't. They really don't, because it's a bunker-like mentality. You know, the Clintons, since 1992, okay? We're talking, actually, even before then, 20-something years, when he first lost his... even before that, when he, you know, won the governorship, then lost it and won it back. The Clintons have always been us against the rest of the world. The whole world is out to defeat us. The whole world is out to get us. So therefore, you can understand their reactions and you can understand their treatment of you and everybody else. They treat the media with disdain until they need them. And then they parade her out and they do what they need to do. Now, I'm a Hillary fan. I think of all the candidates out there, she's definitely the most qualified person to be the president of the United States. She's got the resume. She's got the CV. She doesn't have the personality and the charisma and the ability to inspire enough people. She's done a super job with women. She's done a super job as secretary in countries around the world, raising the status of women. And at the end of the day, she's really not had much of a resume that she can sort of pin to and say, we did this, we did that. And I think that's I realize I've just contradicted myself in these statements, but she's got the experience, but maybe not the experience that's needed to fight now in the 21st century and to conduct diplomacy in the 21st century. So I worry about her ability to be an effective president on the one hand, but then I compare her to what is running against her out there. And, you know, Bernie's a lovely man, and I love what he stands for, and I love what he's tried to do. And I think at the end of the day, it's going to be very difficult, even if he were to be elected, to get anything on his agenda done with the Congress that you have right now.
Well, I do want to address that, and I think that's a very important point. But I want to go in a slightly different direction.
Sure.
Just recently on the Thomas Hartmann show, he had a guest on who was talking about the evidence that's been brought forth on the corrupted elections of 8 and 4. And it's been shown that districts were flipped, that machines were, well, let's just say that the election was stolen. There's enough evidence now.
Oh, I've been covering this story since 2000, literally since right after 2000, when the election happened that established W. I mean, and then, you know, if you look at where they've been able to take this technology. I mean, Diebold, I don't know if you've ever seen the film Hacking Democracy. And you know,
it's been
looked
a long time, yeah.
Yeah, the long time. Hursty hack was done right there in Florida. They're easily manipulated. And I'm still convinced that the Kentucky governor's race had a certain amount of manipulation to it.
Yeah.
But as long as you rely on computerized systems to meet an arbitrary news deadline of 11 p.m. for a decision to be made, you're going to have that. Now, here, I've been told that because we've got two separate ballots, we've got a local ballot, we've got a regional ballot, they'll finish up with the local ballot around about 5 a.m., and then they go on and they count the regional ballot, and you'll be lucky if that's done by 10 or 11 o'clock in the morning after being up all night. Because everyone is marked on a paper ballot. And you sit there and you watch those ballots being counted. You have observers from each party looking at every ballot. We put 650 people into the House of Parliament in May. Every one of those constituencies had people there watching the vote being counted at night. And when they stood up at the end of the night and declared who the winner was in that constituency, you felt good about the democratic process. You saw it happening in front of you. You knew that the vote count was accurate because you watched the people doing it. When you're relying on these Diebold computers, you have no idea what's going in. You can manipulate a crop scanner. You can manipulate a central tabulation computer. You can do, I mean, we had a guy contribute back in the primaries in 2012. Yeah, 2012. They were able to mathematically show from the raw vote count how the Romney campaign was literally flipping in big cities. There were a big article about it. It was so big we got hacked. They tried to shut us down, but I'd given it to LA Progressive and everybody else, and they all ran with the story. And it was all about this former NSA guy who I've known for years, who said, here's how they did it. And he got in touch with a couple of mathematicians out at Cal, and they were able to show, yeah, this is exactly what's happening in every one of the key districts. They were able to look at the raw vote count, and they were able to say, yeah, see, they flipped it in the largest districts by a factor of 10% using the central tabulation computer. So it was enough in most instances to create the surprise wins for Romney in so many of the primaries that he would have otherwise lost. This has been going on for years. I first got really involved with this in Pima County in 2006 over a municipal election. And, you know, the guy broke several of the scanners that we used trying to use the memory cards and replicate a hack for it. He was that ham-fisted and ham-handed that he couldn't get it right. And that thing's been wandering through the courts for 9 years now. And still, they can't get access and transparency. They can't get recounts because of the way the laws have all been structured. It's total bullshit the way your system's put together.
Well, I'm afraid that I feel stronger about it than simply bullshit. I really do. This is literally a coup, and there's no kinder word for it. There's no better word for it. And until that's understood, and what seemed tragic to me when I just recently saw this episode on Tom Hartman, Tom sort of said, well, yeah, that's right. Well, and how, you know, what are we doing about this election sort of thing? You know, like, yeah, we get that. Now what? Well, excuse me, there's no getting past now we get that.
Yeah.
Before you go to, well, how are we going to take Congress, or, you know, the foolishness of this party or that, or the marvel of this candidate and the stupidity of that candidate. Excuse me, the system has been destroyed. It's been co-opted. It has been no more democracy since that point in time. So any arguments about what advantage this or that candidate has is irrelevant when what passes for the powers that be behind the Republican Party have in fact been manipulating the system. That should be the stopping point. That should be the reboot point. And any shenanigans, I mean, it's almost a minor affair that there's this corruption and that corruption when the whole system, soup to nuts, is in fact controlled. You know, when we had the benefit of George Bush's wisdom, when we are theoretically attacked by one group and we invade a different country entirely, and of course the moral hazard that is Richard Cheney, I know we were a laughingstock. I was over in Europe this summer, and I know what kind of opinion they had of us then. This election season, it would be funny if it wasn't so awful for the beacon of democracy on this planet, where people have fled for years for more human freedom, when in fact now they're going to, you know, what are they going to brand Muslims with a brand? Are they going to, you know, have a special identity card? You know, these people here are astounding, an insult to civilization.
And the rest of the world is seeing that. And they're, you know, what's happened is that your moral authority is gone. Now your standing is gone. I mean, most people have a tremendous amount of sympathy for President Obama right now. You know, they couldn't imagine what it would be like to deal with this craziness 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. And it has been insanity. And I shake my head. I don't have answers to questions anymore when I'm asked, and, you know, as a member of the media. You know, I'm interviewed and I said, what is going on? You know, the simplest thing is to say the lunatics are running the asylum. You know, they've allowed, because you don't have any hate speech laws there, so you can get away with anything. You know, here at least you have hate speech laws that can, you can find yourself in jail if you deliberately practice hate speech. So you've got to be extraordinarily careful with what you say and how you say it. You make sure you attack the issue, is not the individual, and you make certain that you're not, you know, pointing a broad brush over a religion, a way of being, et cetera. So you're always looking for, you know, the factual thread throughout. And even still, we end up with the SNP-backed Labour government is dangerous for Britain. Frank Luntz and his tactics have made it across the pond. It's the Americanization of the British electoral system. It'll happen. It'll happen because that's how you reach low-information voters. I'm preferring to reach higher information voters and get them to turn out in much higher numbers because people are fed up with it. They're fed up with the dialogue, the lack of dialogue. They're fed up with the retreat to talking points. And you know, somebody gets asked a question, they never answer the damn question. They just spew a talking point. Well, they give the answer they want to give. Can't do that anymore because people are starting to pay attention. And it's about damn time.
Let me ask you a question about a different aspect of this refugee crisis in Europe. You know, many of us were quite impressed so many years ago that the European Union had an approach that was going to unify Europe, that was going to break down walls, break down barriers, break down borders, and allow for a freer experience on the European continent. And we see now really, really aggressive forces that are seeming to put in place a very different paradigm. Do you feel this is what I'm going to call an innocent confluence of activity, or do you think there's some design behind this re-resurrection of intra-country borders and barriers, new control of people moving across the continent?
Well, you know, part of it is that, and part of it is just the lack of attention to economic growth and development. I mean, the economy in Europe has been crap for the last decade. And when you're not growing the job base and you're seeing a lot of manufacturing jobs disappear to Asia and India and the subcontinent and, you know, and other places where it can be done for cheaper, and good high-quality jobs are disappearing, a lot of people get scared, and justifiably so. And when you start to lose your jobs and your tax base, well, the only thing you can do is focus on how much everything costs and cut. So austerity takes off, and you know, we can't afford to, we're living outside of our means and blah, 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 blah. When my preference is, let's focus on the top line. I've been a business consultant for years, and I don't enjoy working with companies where their first gut instinct and reaction is to just cut something. Yeah, because that you can do. Close that plant. Lay off those people. You'll save money. Well, no, because you may be doing something that looks good to your shareholders, but your stakeholders include your employees, they include your unions, they include the community in which you serve. And if you're not paying attention to all of your stakeholders, soon you're out of business. And if you're out of business, there goes the entire community with it. I prefer to focus on what can we do to bring in new businesses, new opportunities, new jobs, and build the top line. And I'm convinced that if you build the top line by bringing in jobs, by bringing in people, by enthusing them with this being a great place in which to do business, and by going out there and directly selling to CEOs, not building these boondoggle agencies that create these slick films and brochures and, you know, all this crap that doesn't do a thing, but you have a focused, accountable leadership group that go out and actually develop things, you start to grow the top line, all the rest of the stuff gets solved. You have enough money coming in for taxes, to pay for infrastructure, to pay for this, to pay for that. But we're not focusing on growth. We're not focusing on opportunity. We're focusing instead on fear. That guy's got something. He's going to come and take your job. That person's going to come into the country. We're already full, and they're going to take your job. And that's all you hear. When the fact is that the 40-40-40 club doesn't exist anymore. You work for 40 years for 40 hours a week for a 40% cut in pay, also known as a pension. Long gone. Right. Most people aren't going to be like your parents, Rick, my parents, everybody else's parents who had one job for 40 years. We're going to, I mean, I don't know where I am. I'm probably up about 15, 16 different careers and jobs since I graduated from university. And most people are going to be that way. So you've got to have a different model, one that's a prosperity based model as opposed to an austerity based model.
You know, I.
Well, that sounds like a political slogan, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, you are running.
That one would fit on a bumper sticker.
Well, you know, that's a truth that many of us have been aware of for some time in an intellectual sense. But as more of us reach the sixth decade and maybe some of us the seventh decade of time on this planet, it gets dramatically real and visceral. I had a chance to talk to some people overseas in Eastern Europe and in Germany when I was traveling in Europe early this spring. And a comment came across that really just you could just hear the resounding echoes of what this really meant. I talked to a person over in Czechoslovakia who said, or the Czech Republic, who said, you know, when I was growing up, what my parents had was a social pact that said, well, the job might not be great, it might not be terribly interesting, and the pay might not be very well, but they knew there was a place for them to live. They knew they could go get health care, and they knew that when their working time was done, they wouldn't have to beg on the streets. And yeah. They said, now, well, yeah, okay, we have open capitalism in its red fang and claw, but we have no guarantees anymore. Not only do we have crappy jobs, if we have jobs, there's no guarantee of work. There's no guarantee of health care. There's no guarantee of even a place to live. We have less than nothing.
This yeah, the has social, not been... social contract is not being lived up to by anyone anywhere, and that's an issue. Yeah, I love that speech that Elizabeth Warren gave about, you know, you think, you know, you don't have to pay any taxes because you built the business yourself. Well, you didn't build it yourself. You know, your workforce was educated by our schools. You drove your products on our roads. Your company is protected by, you know, the police force. So you have a moral and a social responsibility to do your part to pay back on that contract. And we've lost that. Absolutely no question about it. I believe there should be an NHS type program there, that you should have a healthy workforce, that you should have people who are, you know, focused on taking care of people at all stages of their life. But that doesn't necessarily mean that you just throw things. You have to find a way to pay for these things. You know, so we've not been very good in this country, for example, of figuring out how to take care of deficits and things of that sort. So you've got to be fiscally responsible as well as socially responsible. The problem is that everybody's either on the left just worried about the social responsibility, or on the right just the fiscal. They've got to walk hand in glove, and that's why, you know, we've taken the middle road. We say, okay, let's find out how are we going to pay for this. Well, one of the ways you pay for this, you don't give $5.9 billion in subsidies to the richest companies in the world in the oil industry. That's a real simple one. So, you know, you fight the vested interests where you have to in order to do the smart thing. And then once you do the smart thing, you say, okay, is the social contract being fulfilled, and is the social network there where it needs to be?
You know, I have increasingly gained what I call a seismic perspective on the social paradigm, on the economic paradigm. And here's my thought, and I want to get your reaction to it. You know, if there's an easy adjustment, if this idea that on the one hand we can't afford health care, we can't afford education, we can't afford to have a living wage, but at the same time we won't act against these tax evaders, we won't act against the offshorers, we won't act against corporations that literally make not only millions or billions of dollars in profit, but pay, if not nothing, worse, actually still get tax subsidies. If this can't be adjusted smoothly, easily, readily, then what's going to happen in fits and starts? It's going to happen in great cracks in the social fabric. And,
yeah.
And I find that just worrisome.
And nobody cares. And that's the problem. I mean, the people that are in that situation of owning these businesses are set up in such a way that they get rewarded for every penny that they save, and every penny that they add to the bottom line. So that's why you have these, you know, ridiculous, you know, situations where we had an entire high street in the village of Crick Howell move itself offshore to save taxes because they wanted to have the same benefits that the big guys do. I have people that are saying individually, I paid more taxes than Amazon did here in the UK. And Amazon has an enormous empire and operation here. I pay more in taxes personally than Starbucks paid. So you think there's something wrong with that if businesses are allowed to do that on a regular basis. They always say what we do is 100% legal. Well, then the law needs to be changed and changed everywhere because you cannot continue to just allow them to come in and use resources and rape the entire economy without doing more.
Well, when you go back to that first principles that the election system is rigged and completely manipulable, and when we have stalwarts leading Democratic power like Mr. Gore and Mr. Kerry, who wouldn't stand up to, oh, I don't know, a dawn breeze off the sea, it's hard to imagine any non-violent, non-radical revolutionary solution to this. And I'm afraid that with the level of armament now possessed by small-town cops, it doesn't bode well.
No, no. I mean, Keith Ellison's kid was, you know, had a gun pointed at his head yesterday. He's a representative from
Detroit, isn't it?
Yeah, Detroit, Michigan. And no, not Detroit. He's from Detroit originally. He's in Minnesota. He's from Minneapolis. Okay. And, you know, I've known Keith for a very, very long time. When I saw that tweet, it was very distressing to see that his kid is protesting, you know, very peacefully. And in the background, you can see that a cop has got a gun pointed at his head. And you say to yourself, what the hell is going on? You know, and of course, yes, you know, Keith is a man of color, and he also happens to be Muslim. So,
yeah.
I mean, where do people go for relief if that's the way they're going to be treated?
Well, you know, speaking of conspiratorial paradigms, I recently heard that there are reasons why the demonization of the refugees has occurred. But we'll leave that for another time. Mr. Campbell, Dennis, I want to thank you for your time, and I want to wish you the best in your candidacy for leadership in the nation of Wales. Thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure. Look forward to it. Always.
Thank you, sir. Bye-bye.
All right.
Well, that was our friend Dennis Campbell from the UK Progressive and the Three Muckrakers. You can find them on through Google. And you can tune into their show on iTunes. I do want to salute our sponsors, the Annie Appleseed Project, the Democratic Progressive Caucus of Florida, a trademark attorney. If you need a trademark attorney, please give me a call and I'll let you know who that is. And anonymous bloggers who support the progressive community. And of course, our friends from the Treasure Coast Humanists. Let me play their spot for you. Why are non-religious individuals and families joining Humanists of the Treasure Coast?
Thanks, Rick. People join Humanists of the Treasure Coast to meet other individuals and families who are leading ethical lives free of gods and religion. We educate the public about the positive values associated with humanism, promote the separation of church and state, and work to end discrimination against the non-religious. Humanists of the Treasure Coast is developing a humanist center that provides a supportive environment for humanists, atheists, and agnostics who are tired of feeling pressured to hide their secular outlook on life. To learn more about Humanists of the Treasure Coast, visit us on Facebook or online, or better yet, come to one of our humanist meetings in Jupiter, Stewart, and Vero Beach and join in our discussions.
Well, thanks, Joe. And thanks to the humanists of the Treasure Coast. I also want to thank my good friend, Gwen Holden-Berry, who helped out when I was out of town. And then I also want to thank our good friends in the progressive broadcast community. In addition to Gwen, our good friend Brian Stetton, and of course Harriet Thurman, and our friend Susan Nylon, and of course one last person I have to always remember, our friend Nicole Sandler, who hosted Brooke as a guest on her show recently. Keep it up, good people. Keep it up, you progressives. We need your shoulders to the wheel. We need you to continue to plow this sometimes barren field and at the same time this marvelous, marvelous world to come. So with that, my friends, I'm going to close up a little bit early tonight. I'm going to play our PNN promo. Progressive News Network, a new Mercury Media production, where you'll find the voices of activists, the voices of those working to make this a better world. We believe that as we face challenging times, the human spirit can face and surmount the foolish and the short-sighted. Tune in every Sunday, 7 p.m. Eastern Time, for the live show, or anytime you can. Progressive News Network, found at www.newmercurymedia.com/PNN/. We have a future. Tune in and build it with us. Underwritten by Florida Media Labs, produced by Rick Spivak in cooperation with Canary and a Coal Mine Films. Progressive News Network. And with that, my friends, I'm going to wish you a good night. Hope you tune in next week. And also, I want to urge you, we did a special yesterday on Talent from Tennessee, and one of our artistic shows featuring the two founders of Wooden Strings Puppet Theater. Did a really wonderful show. Check it out. And again, thanks so much, and we'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
Babe's eyes are crazy, babe, tugging at your sleeve.